The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme,
Sergeant Kane was captured a mile or so outside Listowel. A priest was procured to hear his confession. He shook hands with each of us and, of course, told us that he knew we were only carrying out our duty.
We examine the Brigade Activity Reports, the latest release from Ireland's military archives, and find out what new insight they provide into Ireland's revolutionary history. Also,
and there the students actually would have to learn to forget everything that they had learned before.
100 years on, we tell the story of the Bauhaus, the influential German school of art and design, how the school redefined artistic creativity, and why it was shut down by the Nazis in the 1930s. And we'll remember the late historian David Fitzpatrick, who passed away last week. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. We begin this evening with the latest release from the Military Service Pensions Collection. If you wanted to apply for a military pension in a newly independent Ireland, you had to supply detailed information about your service during the War of Independence and the Civil War. Because of this, there are hundreds of thousands of application files in the military archives containing a wealth of first-hand accounts of the Irish Revolutionary period. Since 2014, these documents have been released on the internet in stages, with periodic releases over the past 5 years. This week, the online archive was enhanced further as records known as the Brigade Activity Reports went live, records that shed more light on the events of the period. To talk about them, I'm joined in studio by three guests. Cecile Gordon is Project Manager and Senior Archivist with the Military Service Pensions Project. Archivist Katrina Crow has been closely involved with the project from the beginning, and historian Diarmaid Ferriter is a member of the Academic Advisory Group working on it. You're all very welcome indeed. Cecile, just start by telling us why these particular reports, the Brigade Activity Reports, why they were created in the first place and what kind of information they contain.
They were compiled roughly from the mid-30s by brigade committees that were set up following the request of the referee and the advisory committee to help them cope with the amount of pension applications they were receiving at that time. And it's after the enactment of the Military Service Pensions Act in 1934. And by December 1935, they had received more than 51,000 applications, and it was a real, they were really crumbling under this demand. So we have to remember that under 1934 Act, suddenly the women of Cumannamon could apply, and then the anti-treaty forces as well could apply. So that was really key at that time. Now, the referee had been...
referee was the person who finally adjudicated and decided
his word is the last word.
Yeah.
That's the one that is the person who decides, and he's a judge. At that time, they had already dealt with the clear-cut cases and the cases of people who were in the fighting capacity. But there was still a mass of people out there who were not under that appellation of fighters. So the definition of key man is very important here. Key man is not is a person.
And the key man could be a key woman.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're right to point that out, because this is the definition under which women's application would be judged also. It's a person who was not in a fighting capacity, but whose work was so essential that the operation could not have gone ahead without their work.
The initial applications after the Act was passed in 1924, which obviously excluded anti-treaty forces, excluded women, excluded a number of other categories. There had been, what, about 15, 16,000 applications.
Correct.
But this is three times. In 1934, De Valera is now in power. Obviously, he would have a very different attitude towards anti-treaty forces. But treble the number of applications.
Completely. And the request from the referee evolved as well between 1935 and 1939. He was asking from brigade committees to be set up first, but also to compile records that would list operations and activities in their respective brigade areas And he was asking for the names of participants as well. And that evolved to become a very complex demand. He added, you know, we want also a sketch for every operation, the name of participants, irrespective of what side they took later on during the Civil War. The description of the operation and how far the distance between how far they were from the target, the addresses of people. And then suddenly there was confusion. That goalpost was changing all the time, and on the ground people were very confused, and also some people had moved on, some people had a full-time job, and then 20 years later on were asked for this. And
so was the information quite sketchy, because I would imagine ironically in areas where there wasn't an awful lot of activity it might have been easier to get access or to get that information, because a couple of people who had been, you know, brigade commanders could sit down and spend maybe a couple of weeks because there hadn't been that much activity. But in places like Cork, Kerry, Tipperary, I mean, there were hundreds of incidents.
And it shows through the fire. I mean, Cork One Brigade have dozens of fires, whereas Longford Brigade would have one, Offaly would have two. So it shows, but also places where you thought nothing had happened, the fires are actually very dense of little things, of little activities. And those fires are very good for that, in showing. So obviously, if you want a re-explanation of Michael or things like that, you will be disappointed.
Sounds like the All-Ireland of Revolution. In other words, we have to, you know, we have to show that we played our part.
But also, it's there's the pensions at the back of it all as well. So you have to show that you were active, and people were very eager and very aware of what they were doing and compiling. So some brigade committees were very successful in compiling very dense, very quality information, and others were not at all. And what the files show as well, beyond that, is internal strifes, internal divisions, low level of engagement, lack of willingness to engage with the process. Not only of compiling records, but a disillusionment of the pension process as a whole. So the files show that as well.
Katrina, it strikes me that if you are somebody who was a brigade commander and you're sitting down in 1934 to compile these brigade reports, and you were a member of the National Army in the Civil War, and a number of people in your unit were members of the anti-treaty forces, were a member of the Republican forces, and you're asked to compile an account saying how wonderful they were in the War of Independence and how much they deserve a pension, that you might be disinclined to do so. Would that be...
You mightn't even be talking to them. Mm. You know, it's not that long after the end of the Civil War. There's one file, I think, that we're only starting to scratch the surface of these files. I think it's the East Limerick Brigade, Cecile, where there's a fierce row going on between two members of the brigade committee. And they were both on the Free State Army side, so they're just fighting about personalities.
But they still hate each other.
They still hate each other, and it's still a classic Irish thing of there you go. But the point you make is, I'm sure, going to be borne out by all kinds of interesting things. And, of course, people didn't always obey what they were asked to do by the referee and advisory committee. One of the famous ambushes in Clare, the Renin ambush, which is in September 1920, what we get on that file is a report from An Cosintór, the Defence Forces magazine from 1941, describing the ambush perfectly, but omitting any of the names. And then a fascinating letter dealing with one of the participants, Commandant Patrick Lahan, who was caught up in the reprisals that took place afterwards. In Renin, there were six RIC men, five RIC men and one soldier killed. But the reprisals the next night in Lahinch, Ennistymon and Milltown Malby burned 26 houses and killed six civilians. So the usual disproportionate response. And this poor divil gets caught in the wrong place in Lahinch. He's shot and then he's thrown into the flames of his burning house. And the next day, a commandant is heard to be, or from the British Army, is heard to say to somebody, congratulations on shooting one of them shinners and then burning the damned rat. And this gives you a sense of the horrible stuff that was going on. But the brigade committee there did not do what they were asked to do. They didn't send a list of names. They did send a sketch, all right, a very nice sketch, it must be said, showing where the ambush took place, and it's described in the piece. But where are the names of those who the referee and advisory committee would have wanted? And Cecile would know more than I, but I'm sure they vary a lot, these reports. They're not consistent in the sense that you're going to get a fully fledged new history of the War of Independence. But what you're going to get are fantastic incidental things and a lot of very good stuff that will fill gaps that were not filled before.
Dermot, talk to me a little bit more about this notion of the the key men who, you know, we'll use the term key men because that's the term that is used, but they could be, as we were saying, they could be key women. These are people in vital non-combat roles. And for the first time, I think, they're able to apply for pensions.
Well, there was a problem from the outset in 1924 when the pensions process began, which was that the pensions were supposed to be for those who rendered active service. It remains very vague as to what constitutes active service, and it's very contested. And a lot of the bureaucrats are arbiters, of course, in these disputes. But now with this Brigade Activity Report's development, the key men can become arbiters and can carry significant power, I think it's fair to say, as well. But you get a lot of information on the non-combat roles. For example, there were crucial jobs being done in relation to disruption and destruction of infrastructure, destroying of bridges, the building of blockades. And there's a very interesting file from the 5th Dublin Brigade about those who were electricians and carpenters and engineers who were involved, again, in preparing for some very, very important military events during the War of Independence. But they're kind of taken out of circulation from the regular brigades to do this particular work. But they don't, you know, they're not involved in combat. So they're identified as people who need to be looked after. There's also those who were working on the railways who were sympathetic to the Republican cause and who often suffered greatly if they were caught, you know, with dispatches or transporting messages or whatever it was. And again, the idea that they need to be given recognition. But you also get a sense that some of the key men aren't around. One of the things that I really find valuable about this archive is that it sheds light on the afterlife of the revolution. Even something as simple as a list. Okay, here are the 35 men that I'm identifying as having been involved, but you get where they are now. So you get a simple list, and one of the ones I was looking at, Cork IRA Brigade, and this is in the 1930s, there's 35 of them mentioned, and then you see where they are. Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Asylum, England, deceased, and of course many of them are still living locally. It's quite bleak, but it also makes you realise there's an exile that comes, particularly in the aftermath, and even some of those who aren't physically gone are what Alice Milligan described as mental internees in their own country.
Many of those would have been Ernie O'Malley types.
They would.
Who would have fought
it makes you think about this.
But emigrated.
Yeah, Ernie O'Malley would have said in his memoirs that we had built an emotional world of our own, you know, as IRA members, but we'd no social or economic framework. So when the fighting is over, there's a very difficult period of transition, and many of them do end up abroad. So you get all of that kind of information. So, the key men, you know, they are trying to identify, they're trying to locate. A lot of it depends on the drive and energy that they have. There's a funny letter from Seamus McCoss. Well, it's not funny, but he's quite cross in 1935. And again, he's old Cork, old IRA from Cork. And he says, I work from 9 o'clock in the morning till 7:30 at night. And now you, the referee, expect me to come home and begin another job at 7:30, trying to track down everybody and get information and so on. But even those key men could decide what was worthy of inclusion and what wasn't. And of course, there's going to be divisions and disputes. And even the old IRA men associations, some of whom have taken on a kind of a welfare function, they can also divide then. So there is the potential for all that. And we have to remind ourselves, this is not the truth. It's not a pure, definitive history of the War of Independence or anything like it. But it does give us such a voluminous archive. I mean, the shades and the contours and the human colour and the human dilemmas, and just the level, even the maps that they're asked to use. And I mean, the referees can be very strict, and there's a lot of resentment towards the bureaucrats. Sometimes it's misplaced because they were doing a tough job as well. But you can appreciate that if somebody is continually being told you're not providing either accurate enough information or your sketches are not up to standard. You know, there's even a cartography of the revolution in this archive.
Katrina, new information, apparently I would have thought it would be very difficult to get new information on this particular operation, but relating to Bloody Sunday, is that true?
Well, we had a symposium in the in Colliborough Barracks last Saturday week precisely because of the release of the Brigade Activity Reports, and we had a number of wonderful historians, including Dermot, speaking at that. Our first speaker was Anne Dolan, who's our philosopher historian, who asks more questions than anybody else, and they're always fascinating questions. So she said that in the report she had looked for Bloody Sunday, there are two documents and there are two lists of names of the people who were sent out on Bloody Sunday morning to kill the Cairo gang. She found two names she hadn't come across before. What she did then was give us a masterclass in how you follow those names into the pensions files. and discover what happened to them, get more information about the operation itself, and then the afterlife, which is what these files, Dermot has referred to it, are so important for. These files are not just a history of the War of Independence and the Civil War. They're a sort of mini social and economic history of Ireland for the people who participated in these events and for their relatives. So a large number of people are connected into this. And I suppose one of the things to really emphasise is that this is an entirely interconnected collection of archives. So you have the pensions files, disability files, brigade activity reports, nominal roles for the standing of the IRA at different points in time, photographs, maps, all of these things connect with each other. And between them all, and if you throw in the Bureau of Military History as well, what we have is probably the best documented revolution anywhere in the world.
And a wonderful source for historians, for academic historians, but also a wonderful source for local historians, a wonderful source for anybody who is looking to find out something about the history of their family. You can literally sit in your front room. I did it last night with a granduncle. You can find out some absolutely extraordinary and quite hair-raising things about your own family. Okay, a number of extraordinary letters, obviously, in this collection. We're going to introduce you to a pair of letters. They are connected. They show two different perspectives on an execution, which took place in Kerry on the 16th of June, 1921. The executed man was James Kane, a fishery inspector and a former RIC sergeant, and he was killed for espionage. We're going to hear extracts from those letters. We'll hear first from Dennis Quill, who was the column commander of the 6th Battalion Flying Column in North Kerry. And here he gives his account of the execution.
Sergeant Kane was captured a mile or so outside Listowel. A priest was procured to hear his confession. Kane asked me permission to write to his children. This I granted readily, provided I could read it and send it through our own messengers. He was very thankful. He also asked me prior to his death, 1, that he should be shot on the main road to Listowel, and 2, that he should be shot in such a manner so that there would be no lingering death. I informed him that I would personally see that this was done. In the letter, which he wrote to his family, he gave us every praise. He shook hands with each of us and, of course, told us that he knew we were only carrying out our duty.
The words there of Dennis Quill. Now, he mentions that Kane asked for permission to write a letter to his children, and we also have that very letter. Kane writes to his children to say goodbye. He also talks about practical matters, bills to pay, outstanding debts to settle. Here's an extract.
I am condemned to die. I had the priest today, thank God. I give you all my blessing and pray that God may protect you all. Pray for me and get some masses said for me. Pay Fairley and McKenna as far as possible and see to Mrs. Elder's and Mr. O'Carroll's bills, also Mr. Breen and the butcher's bills. Don't go too much expense of the funeral and have no drink or public wake. I am told that my body will be got near home. I got the greatest kindness from men who were in charge of me. Goodbye, my dear children. Bury me near my loving wife, if possible. Give my gold watch to Eddie and the watch in the desk to Frank.
And then he shook hands with his executioners, the words there of James Kane. That's only a part, an extract from the letter. The letter is actually more detailed and contains reference to even more financial transactions, and is extraordinary, the kind of things that go through your mind when you know that you are about to die. I think that's, for you, one of the most interesting documents in all of these reports.
Personally, yeah, because it's so unusual to find this in the type of files that we have, which are not individual claims for pension, but that shows so much humanity as well in places that you wouldn't expect to find it. And for me, the fact that there are three interconnected documents, it shows a very good way of using the collection as well, because here you are, a letter from a flying column commander describing something really grim, an execution, but he remembers things and he adds that to his letter. And not only that, and we have the letter of the man he executed, not him himself, but he's naming the firing party in his letter as well, which adds another dimension to it. He also says that Kane asked to be killed quickly, and that he should be done. That should be done
he
on the main road.
Specifically, where his body should be left.
Yeah, because he wanted his body to be found very easily. Yeah. And again, when we want as well for people to come to, you know, understandings, like you can use those documents. You don't have to use the whole thing. But if you take those three documents together, you have a story. Because Dennis Quill doesn't stop here. And Katrina said so rightly, it's all interconnected. Dennis Quill has an individual file in the pension. And when you go to his file, you have other stories from there. And Dennis Quill is very active.
Bureau of Military History, perhaps, as well? I don't know. I mean, you both,
it's
very different.
If he doesn't have one, he's definitely
referred to. Yes.
Because he's not only active himself on a number of very key operations, including other executions in North Kerry, but he's also a reference for other men, for other claims. So his name comes up again and again and again. So if you start from the Brigade Activity Files in this particular instance, and then you go to Dennis Quill's individual files, from this file you find the names of hundreds of other people who may or may not have files in the collection, and you have those different roads coming from this. And I think that's a really good strength of the collection, because you're down the rabbit hole very, very quickly. But it's a very good use of interconnected, for grim events, it re-injects a little bit of human in there. And I think that's another strength of the collection in itself.
Let's talk a little bit about an aspect of this, an aspect of the War of Independence that often gets ignored, and that's Northern Ireland, Diarmaid, because one of the things that I have here in front of me is a letter from 2nd Brigade, 3rd Northern Division. And that contains something that I must say I was completely unaware of. Just take, for example, July of 1921, the truce, which is fine if you are in what was to become the Free State, but it didn't apply in Northern Ireland, did it?
There ain't no truce in Ulster, and this comes through very strongly when you consider that violence actually peaked in Northern Ireland after the truce. And it's a reminder that the Northern experience of the War of Independence and Civil War is very, very different. Now, for some very obvious reasons, you know, the IRA is only going to be strong in certain parts of Ulster for obvious reasons of sectarian divisions. So you can have a strong IRA in Monaghan and in South Armagh and in South Down, places like that. But you go into East Down or you go to Antrim, the way one of the letters puts it in the 1930s.
This is from Antrim.
You know, we're dealing with an overwhelmingly imperial population. So obviously they have a very different experience, and they have very little to show for it. They have nothing to show for it. I mean, the IRA in what became Northern Ireland, they weren't able to prevent partition. They weren't able to prevent the border. They couldn't sell the War of Independence as a success or partly a success at all. And then the hurt and the sense of abandonment, what Cathair Healy described, he was the Sinn Féin MP in the early 1920s for Tyrone Fermanagh. We've been sold into political servitude for all time. That sense of betrayal and abandonment comes through the brigade activity reports as well, because they have also had the added complication, not just that Dublin won't listen to them, and James Gallagher, who's writing on behalf of the Derry City Brigade of the IRA, says the general feeling here is that you, Dublin, are putting obstacles in our way, but they have the added complication that it's very dangerous for them in this new state of Northern Ireland to be amassing material relating to the IRA during the War of Independence. And the RUC is onto them. And they actually refer to material having to be destroyed as a result of that. Now, that didn't apply to the South, so they're facing that barrier as well. So when you consider the complications that were there for them during the War of Independence, and of course, they also inflicted some horrors on the Protestant population, that has to be acknowledged, and that'll come out too. But they are facing that constant sense of abandonment. And that lasts and endures. I mean, even the 1950s, you can see that they're trying to get Dublin to listen to them and hear their concerns, and they feel the door of Leinster House has been shut in their faces. So that's an aspect of the War of Independence that we really need to begin thinking about. We can be quite partitionist in our own way of thinking about the overall War of Independence.
Did you come across much of this material, any of this material, when you were researching your most recently published book, The Border?
Oh, I did, because, again, it's in keeping with that theme of what happens after Dublin shuts its door. You know, what is the status of Northern Nationalists? Can they cohere? Can they organise themselves effectively? This process, the Brigade Activity Reports, was an opportunity for them to come together. But you also, again, get the theme of exile. Because whatever, again, about the exile of those who were fighting in the south, it's even more pronounced for those who were in Ulster, for the very obvious reason that so many of them cannot settle in this new state. And there's a very significant exodus that Eunan O'Hoppe and Fergal McGarry have drawn attention to. And we need to bring that into our framework of interpretation for the impact and legacy of this period of the War of Independence.
You went beyond, to some extent, what was available in the files, because you went to UCD, I think, and to the papers of Sean McKeown. Just explain what that was all about. I'm looking at a beautiful map.
The maps.
With absolutely beautiful handwriting. I mean, a tiny handwriting. You would need a magnifying glass, actually. I certainly, wearing glasses, would still need a magnifying glass to read some
of it. That's a really good strength of the collection, as well as the sketches and maps. We have around 400 sketches and maps with the Brigade Activity Reports, and those Longford maps were actually, they are housed in UCD archives. And we were lucky enough to collaborate with UCD to be able to scan them at a very, very high standard and to have really, really good copies of them. They're really large. They're 6 inch to the mile. And they were referenced in the Longford Brigade activity file, but we had no maps there. When I think Mary Coleman, who's very clued in when it comes to Longford, said, well, I think Sean McKeown's papers in UCD. So we contacted UCD, and there they were all noted, metadata, and everything. So we brought them to Carbery Barracks to scan them with specialist equipment, and digitally, basically, added them to complete the collection very beautifully. What Sean McKeown did to those maps is also very good, because he annotated them so heavily that you get a full background of the operation. You get a lot of metadata. He has listed all the participants at key. He plotted them on the maps, but also he listed women, the names of women who were present at first aid stations. So, as you may have gathered, women are very absent from those type of files, and there they are now on the map. And so that's our job now, to try and find those women in the files. Whether they have applied or not, that's a different a story, but we'll try to link them to those as well.
I'm looking, Dermot, at a photocopy of a brief brigade report. It's Newry Company, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Brigade, 4th Northern Division, and a beautiful handwriting. It's written in pencil. One name leaps out, involved in, I think, what was it? It was an ambush, and that's Frank Aiken.
Well, Frank Aiken.
Busy man.
A busy man, but also a very frustrated man. And you've got to consider the dilemma that Frank Aiken was facing. Hardened though he was well aware that the viability of the Northern Offensive was in question. You know, when you consider by the spring of 1922, they're getting very conflicting signals, the Northern IRA, because they're being, you know, Michael Collins is speaking out of both sides of his mouth, you know, and he was saying, OK, we need to have some sense of an ongoing operation to destabilise the state of Northern Ireland. But Frank Aiken is wondering, well, where is this going? You know, and what can be the possible outcome of this? Because we simply don't have the resources or the support for it to be in any way successful. And this comes through Aiken's papers as well, that frustration. On the one hand, he has the reputation of being hardline and of being absolutist, but he's clever enough to know that militarily and indeed politically, this is just not going to work. And of course, that offensive really peters out by May 1922. And again, they're left with a sense of, you know, complete and utter disillusionment. And again, I think abandonment. So Aiken, of course, goes on to build a very successful career, but he also serves for so long as Minister for External Affairs, what we now call Foreign Affairs, at a much later stage. His Armagh background is still very, very relevant, and he has very, very strong views on partition, and he's always looking for an international audience to bang the anti-partition drum, even when he's an old man.
You talk about his duration or his survival as Foreign Minister or Minister for External Affairs. There's a famous cartoon of, is it Dublin Opinion? And he's flying into New York and the Statue of Liberty is waving. How are you, Frank? finally, briefly, Katrina, if you could. I mean, this, I sense a great sense of excitement from you. But also, this is, it's a very democratized archive. You, anybody can access it, and you don't even have to come up to Dublin to access it.
No, the decision to place this material online free to access and with superb catalogues, which means you can search them really well. All credit to the archivists who are working on the project, Cecile and her team, for giving us this Rolls-Royce catalogue, which makes it available to scholars, to citizens, to anybody who wants to look at it. This is really making a difference in terms of how well-informed people are coming up to the anniversaries that we're all going to be confronting over the next 4 years. Everybody can go online, look at this, look at the Bureau of Military History, and get an interesting, complicated picture of what was going on in their locality. This is an absolute treasure trove for local history, as you yourself discovered, looking at your own family, and for family history in a way that we don't have otherwise. There's going to be value to these records way into the future. Historians in the future will think of ways of using these, things like linguistic analysis, which isn't so much used now. And it's both nationally and internationally significant because, as I said earlier, this is probably one of the best documented revolutions in the world. There are going to be uses for this far into the future. And can I finish by paying tribute to the Department of Defence and the Armed Forces for supporting this project steadfastly from the beginning? We wouldn't have it without their support, and they are determined that it will be finished to its finality. So what we will end up with is a magnificent legacy of our decade of centenaries that actually adds to the national knowledge of what went on during those turbulent years.
What Cecile has been overseeing here, and I said this at the symposium last week, it's a model that can be held up internationally and acclaimed as the right way and the best way to do it. And it's something we should be very proud of. And it's something that Cecile and her team deserve enormous credit
for. And free access.
And free access. Very, very important. There's a wealth of material in this release of documents. We're going to be referring to them again, I know, on this programme again and again as we approach the centenaries of some of those engagements in the War of Independence. But we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, three of you very much. Cecile Gordon, Katrina Crowe and Dermot Ferrisher for joining us this evening to talk about the Brigade Activity Reports, the latest release from the Military Service Pensions Collection. And of course, the documents are available to browse online now, as is the accompanying guidebook, and you'll find them in the online collections at militaryarchives.ie. Go and have a look. After the break, 100 years on since its foundation, we visit Berlin and tell the story of the influential German art school, the Bauhaus.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
A quick word about the inaugural Galway History Festival, which begins this Wednesday the 6th and runs until the 16th of March, being run by NUI Galway, and there'll be a wide range of events, many of them free, taking place around the city. One example which caught our eye is a discussion at the Blackgate Cultural Centre on Francis Street at 3:15 next Saturday afternoon, and the subject is What Use Is History? In 2019. And Katrina Crowe, from whom we've just heard, is one of the panellists on that discussion. All the details are at galwayhistoryfestival.wordpress.com, and we'll put a link on our own website. Now, this year marks the centenary of the opening of the Bauhaus, the most famous art school in modern history. The German school's brief 14-year existence mirrored that of the Weimar Republic from 1919 to 1933. It was born of a renewed liberal and artistic spirit in Germany following the country's defeat in World War I. In this piece, writer and broadcaster Jonathan Creasy reports from Berlin on the history and the influence of the Bauhaus.
The German school of art and design known as the Bauhaus, literally building house or school of building, was founded in revolutionary times when utopian ideas had both appeal and the force of necessity.
My name is Anne-Marie Yegge. I'm the director of the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin. The Bauhaus really wanted to change something, not only in the lines of education, but also in creating something that they called the new man or the new human being. They wanted to create a new kind of artist.
The Bauhaus was founded in 1919 by architect Walter Gropius, who envisioned a unity between arts, crafts, and industry that would not only train a new generation of modern artists, but also benefit the lives of ordinary people.
Well, I still remember when I came out of the First World War, I thought everything would snap back as it has been before, until one day, all of a sudden, I became aware that I would have to take part in something completely new, which would change the conditions I had been living in before.
You're hearing the voice of Walter Gropius from a collection of oral histories, Bauhaus Reviewed, available from LTM Recordings.
Walter Gropius always was very interested in a new kind of education for artists.
And I was aware, after what I had done already as an architect, that in order to really penetrate, that couldn't be done by one person alone. You have to build up a whole school which follows certain principles out of which it may develop. And that gave me the idea for organizing the Bauhaus.
In building his school, Gropius invited some of the world's most important artists, and the school's faculty and students would ultimately shape much of 20th century visual culture. But it is as a school of ideas that the Bauhaus remains most vital today, almost a century after its closing.
The real new thing that Gropius introduced is a preliminary course, and there the students actually would have to learn to forget everything that they had learned before.
This preliminary or basics course became the core of Bauhaus education. It's an approach that still influences art and design education today, as it's rooted in fundamental ways of seeing and perceiving the world. Two of the key figures at the Bauhaus came together in the basics course, and they later became living examples of Bauhaus ideas in North America and around the world. Of course, we're talking about the legendary artistic couple, Annie and Josef Albers.
Annie Fleischmann, or Anneliese Fleischmann, came from a very wealthy Berlin family and was a gifted artist in the textile classes. Both Josef and Annie had this very long period in time of education before they actually became real artists, thanks to the Bauhaus.
Despite the liberal utopian leanings of the Bauhaus, the reason Annie Albers took up textile design while her partner Josef ran the basics course while painting and making glass sculptures was that roles for women, even in the Bauhaus, were circumscribed.
In 1919, when the first German democracy was established, the right to vote for women was also introduced. And Gropius, in the first Bauhaus Manifesto of 1919, proclaimed that women and men would be handled equally. But if you really look how women were treated, you do have to say that Gropius himself and all the other teachers lived in a, let's say, a kind of world which was still rooted in the 19th century and which was a man's world.
From the beginning, the Bauhaus was plagued by the extreme political volatility in Germany between the wars.
And every time the school was shut down because a new and stronger coalition of the right, and already starting in Weimar, already the National Socialists in this coalition, the first thing they would do when they came to power would to close the school. So this happened in Weimar, it happened in Dessau, and then at the very end in 1933 also in Berlin. And that was the end then.
The Nazis brought an end to the Bauhaus, along with so much else in German society, but a group of Bauhaus artists, including the Albers, emigrated to countries around the world, and they brought Bauhaus ideas with them. There is no doubt that the design products of the Bauhaus have influenced a century of visual culture around the world. You see its influence in furniture, architecture, and crafts of all kinds. But, as Dr. Yegi points out, there is more we can take from the Bauhaus than just the items its artists produced.
What I believe is much more important, something like eternal questions you ask yourself, how do we want to live today? How can we set the human being in the middle of our interest when we build or when we design? And of course, nowadays we have completely different answers to this. So I don't think you see the Bauhaus as much. Maybe you feel it, or you see that there are ongoing questions that have to be posed and have to be answered in every generation and in a different way in every generation.
Prast. Right, and that was Jonathan Creasy reporting from Berlin on the story of the German art school, the Bauhaus. And if you want to find out more about the Bauhaus and read some reflections on its significance in this centenary year, you can go to Bauhaus100.com. After the break, and following his passing, sadly, last week, we will be remembering the great historian David Fitzpatrick.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your text. As we mentioned on last Sunday's programme, the news was announced last week of the passing of historian David Fitzpatrick. And we're going to spend the rest of the programme tonight looking at his career as an historian. He was a pioneering scholar who published on a really incredibly wide range of subjects. And we're going to begin with the voice of Professor Fitzpatrick himself. And this is a clip from a 2008 programme called Our War, The Great Debate. It was a radio forum, which I chaired at the time, on the subject of how we remember World War One. It derived from the John Horne edited volume Our War. And here David Fitzpatrick is talking about Irish memory, our memory of World War One, and rejecting the idea that there was a great forgetting or amnesia of the conflict in Ireland.
We have greatly overemphasised the degree to which this epochal event and its impact upon the Irish people has been ignored. And I'm attempting to popularise an alternative word, aphasia, representing loss of speech rather than loss of memory. It was as if there was a conspiracy throughout 26 counties of this island not to utter, not to give voice to the collective memory which was ubiquitous. So aphasia, I do think that there was a loss of speech. And that loss of speech was most common, I fear to say, among my own kind, among historians.
And you can see there that he spoke as well as he wrote, David Fitzpatrick, talking about aphasia and an inability to speak or communicate with regards to Irish memory of World War One. I must say, an idea that struck me at the time and has resonated in the years since then. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Fionnuala Walsh, lecturer in modern history at University College Dublin and a former student of David's. On the line from Oxford is Professor Eunan O'Halpin of Trinity College Dublin, where David worked for almost 40 years. And also joining us on the line is historian from London, is historian Roy Foster, a great admirer and a great friend of David Fitzpatrick. And Roy, let's start with you. We heard there, David, speaking about our memory of World War One, and one of the things that comes across is how articulate and how penetrating he was.
Yes, what comes across there too is, I think, a brilliant comprehension of psychology. He was a very good psychologist. One of the things that made reading him a delight and an unpredictable delight was the way that he could arrow in on the way people thought and sometimes the way people deceived themselves. His first great book, Politics and Irish Life, really started me thinking about revolutions as generational experiences ages ago. This was 40-odd years ago, and I still remember reading where he wrote that revolution offered people involved in it a route of escape from their parish and family. They went on the run, not only from the police, but from their childhood. You know, nobody was writing about the Irish Revolution like that then. And his influence is so strong because his perceptions were so unique and so powerful.
He was somebody who was fascinated, I think, by conspiratorial groups, whether it be in Politics and Irish Life, which was about Clare, whether it was about the IRA in Clare, whether it was about the Masons or the Orange Order. He was very interested in how people came together.
Well, he was fascinated by the way people linked together and the way that social bonds brought people into strange associations. And of course, his very last book, published when he was very ill, on Ernest Blythe, showed an extraordinary, you know, world of people who, like Blythe, could be members of the Orange Order, but also hardline Republicans. I think also Miles, a book which shows this psychological apprehension of how people operated together, was his great book on emigration, Oceans of Consolation, where again you read things like, I'm quoting from this, like marriage, emigration was expensive, premeditated, calculated, and the outcome of negotiations involving a wide circle of interested relatives and the collection of extensive evidence concerning available options. unlike an Irish marriage, it was also reversible and repeatable.
Fionnuala, you were his student. His impact on mentoring the next generation of historians has been profound, hasn't it? It's really an important part of his legacy.
It really is. I think it's one of his most significant legacies. As well as teaching many undergraduates in Trinity College over the 40 years he worked there, David also supervised over 20 PhD students, many of whom are still working in academia today. And he was a really hands-on supervisor. Took a really rigorous approach to our scholarship, always challenged us to think big, to be ambitious, to be brave with our scholarship. But he could be a difficult taskmaster. He could be critical, but he, above all, was incredibly encouraging, both during the PhD process and in the years on the job market and years afterwards.
You didn't even have to do a PhD to benefit from that kind of mentoring, because he was very much involved in something in Trinity over the years, the history workshop.
That's right, yeah. So in the 1980s, he taught an undergraduate course, the first of its kind in Ireland, on Ireland in the First World War. And this led to the first Trinity History Workshop, which was a group of his undergraduate students who together produced a book, which he edited, called Ireland in the First World War. And it was the first edited collection to look at Ireland's experience in the First World War. And over time, that workshop produced four books, and David edited three of them. Most recently, of course, Terror in Ireland.
And, I mean, your subject area, your thesis was on the impact of the Great War on women in Ireland. So he was an obvious port of call,
I would imagine, right from the
beginning.
Yeah, I was very familiar with his scholarship before I ever met him. And he profoundly influenced the work that I did. His work, there's no First World War scholarship in Ireland which is not profoundly indebted to him. And he shaped my thesis to a very large extent. But he made me the historian that I am. He challenged me to think big, to be brave, to be ambitious.
Eunan Halpin, you worked with him for many, many years. Did he similarly challenge his colleagues? I mean, I know he had he could have a quite laconic delivery, but also a very astringent when it came to methodologies, and an opinionated man.
In terms of methodology, David was extraordinarily rigorous, and I think to some extent what Roy says is entirely true, and what Fionnuala said, but it's underpinned. David did not make generalizations that weren't based on, if you like, on very detailed micro studies. I think in that he was enormously influenced by his own background, that he had a very strong interest in, if you like, in social and economic data. So he wasn't simply writing from, as it were, from the heart or from what people said in letters home or whatever. He was also looking at people in terms of who they were, where they belonged in a family, where they belonged in society. So it said he was coming from the sort of, I would say, from an almost Marxist training in historical analysis. But he was able to marry that with an insight into individual personality, and as Roy has said, into, if you like, into group the dynamics of groups and so on.
And how did his ideas on the revolutionary period jibe with your own ideas on the revolutionary period? Because that's a period that with which, you know, I would very much associate you. And if those ideas, did those ideas clash from time to time?
I'm sure, yeah, of course they would clash in detail and in general terms. I think, for example, David was far more aware and mindful of the Ulster issue and of Northern Ireland. We think of David as an Irish historian. He was an all-Ireland historian. He was, as Roy has mentioned, his interest in the Orange Order and so on. He absolutely looked at things on, if you like, on an insular basis. And to some extent, I think he was inclined, perhaps less in writing than in discourse, to downplay the sort of aspirations of the Irish Revolution and so on. But if you read what he wrote, as distinct sometimes from what he said, I think you'll read something, stuff which is very often persuasive, which is very rigorous, which isn't polemical, and which is, if you like, highly scientific in background.
Okay, we've heard Eunan and Roy both talking about Oceans of Consolation. We're going to hear another clip from David now. We found this in the RTE Radio Archives, taken from a 1983 documentary called Irish Down Under, examining the historical experience of Irish emigrants to Australia. And in this extract, David is talking about the upward mobility of those emigrants.
In countries like the United States or Britain, strongly entrenched establishments were successful in largely excluding first-generation Irish emigrants from the best and most desirable jobs and residential areas. But in Australia, the Irish arrived before any native establishment had been erected, and the Protestant aversion to the papist swarm was ineffectual. The most spectacular feats of Irish upward mobility were, it must be admitted, generally accomplished by Protestants from Ireland, including the many otherwise unemployable surplus graduates of Trinity College Dublin, who came to dominate the Melbourne bar and public life.
Roy, how important were his own origins in Australia to him? Because we mostly associate him as being a student of Irish history.
They were very important. He came from a very distinguished intellectual family. His sister is a very distinguished historian. His father was a distinguished Australian intellectual. He also came to Ireland through Cambridge, which is important. And he was somebody who was very internationally minded. When I think of the work he was producing in the 70s, I think of books like Eugene Weber's Peasants into Frenchmen. I think of Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities. He was that kind of mind, and he always looked outside Ireland. The other thing I completely agree with what Eunan was saying was that he was an absolutely ferocious analyst of statistics, which you often think of as making a boring historian. It had exactly the opposite effect with him. But great articles like On the Disappearance of the Irish Agricultural Labourer or The Geography of Irish Nationalism were grounded, as his very recent work was, too, in statistical number crunching, which he brought in near genius to.
Okay, that's unfortunately all we have time for. There's so much more we could say about David Fitzpatrick's life and work, but time is against us. Fionnuala Walsh, Eunan O'Halpin and Roy Foster, thank you very much for joining us this evening and sharing your reflections and memories of the late David Fitzpatrick. My thanks tonight also to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. Our readers this evening were Mark Manning and Colin Flynn. The History Show was a Pegasus production for RTE. From me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.